fait, là, serait un recul pour nous, travailleuses et travailleurs du Québec.
Good evening. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. I'm your host, Sarah De A, recording from home on January 28th, 2021. On tonight's show, my guests, Lydie Dubuisson, author of Sanctuary and artistic associate at Black Theater Workshop.
A lot of topics that are explored, but religion is not something that we talk about a lot on our stages. And that makes me realize that there's a layer of society that we just like really don't talk about. And yet there's so many girls in that situation who still live by their community and who feel the pull of what do I want to keep and what do I want to free myself from of that community.
Emma Tibaldo of Playwrights Workshop Montreal and co-creator of Skin.
Getting old, space is diminishing. You know, as you get older, your space gets smaller. It just does. You move less. Everything becomes part of your imagination. Like, you live so much more in your head.
And Bill Fletcher, director of Leading Ladies at Lakeshore Players Dorval.
It's like doing a painting and then putting it up on the wall so that somewhere public so people can see it. It's a team sport that does that, but it's actually getting the thing done and having it out in public. And if it's not very good, well, it's not very good. And if it is very good, holy smokes, is it fun.
Before we begin, some updates. Haitian dancer and choreographer Eddie Toussaint will be honored with the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Achievement Award this Saturday as part of the Black Theatre Workshop's annual Vision Gala. Born in Port-au-Prince, Toussaint eventually came to Montreal and Quebec. According to the Canadian Encyclopedia Online, his work in the 70s often featured acrobatic, sensual choreography set to Quebecois pop songs. Artistic, but approachable. His work then later took on a more balletic approach. Toussaint founded a ballet company of his own name in Laval. It presents shows and offers up classes as well. More on BTW's gala in a few minutes. Congratulations to Eddie Toussaint. And the Festival Transamérique has found the person, or rather persons, to take over from Martin Fauché in 2022. Martin Denevald and Jesse Mill were selected to be co-artistic directors of the International Performance Art Festival. Martin announced last year that he would be gradually stepping back from managing the festival. As for his successors, Martin has worked as a dramaturge and in arts management for theaters and festivals all over Europe. And Jesse has been with the FTA since 2014 as a dramaturg and artistic advisor and has worked in local theater and dance. Congrats to them both, and hopefully we'll be talking with them in the weeks to come. Now on to our conversations tonight. I want you to picture a teenage girl sitting in a church discussing the ins and outs of life with her sister, her best friend, her godmother, and God too. The conversations tangle with the questions this teen is having about herself, her faith, and her place in the world. She is the hero of Sanctuary, a work in progress by author Lydie Dubuisson. Lydie is a Haitian Quebecer who grew up outside of Montreal, speaking Haitian Creole, French, and English, languages she threads throughout her work, including Sanctuary. Lydie is also a new artistic associate at Black Theater Workshop, and a reading of her play kicked off the theater's 50th season earlier this month. It's online if you'd like to catch it, and I encourage you to do so. But first, have a listen to my conversation with Lydie Dubuisson from earlier this week. Hello, Lydie. Welcome to Upstage. How have you been?
I am doing as wonderful as you can be, I guess. Is that a clear answer?
Absolutely.
Lately, I've been enjoying saying, I woke up this morning. That's how I'm doing. I woke up this morning.
I love that positivity, but also honesty. It's been a very busy month for you. You helped kick off Black Theater Workshop's 50th season with a reading of a play that you've been working on called Sanctuary. How long have you been writing Sanctuary for, actually?
Sanctuary was quite an experience, and it's that's when you accept that you are a playwright, that it's going to take more than a year to write a play. I started writing Sanctuary, like the first time that I wrote a scene about that play was in 2018. It's a play I always knew I was going to write, but in 2018 was when I really tried my first draft. I've been exploring it with a residency that I had at the MAI, a studio residency, and I was able to have actors reading the second draft of my script. Then I took a break. I took a break from the script because we are influenced by the time, and by the times and what happens around us. I wanted to take some time to really soak in the story that I wanted to tell and how to send it out in the world. And in 2019, that's when I really started to revisit the script again after a couple of months of taking a break. And once I got a residency with Théâtre aux Écuries, that was offered to me in February 2020, oh my God, it's already far away. That's when it gave me another go. And that's when I was like, okay, now this time, this is the last straw. And this is my third draft. Every time I do a draft, some of the characters die. Some characters disappear. And I'm like, oops, that one's gone. So I think that I started with a first draft with something like 8 characters to exactly the third draft being only 4 characters. And I'm still developing the play because now I write in a multilingually, I guess. I start in English, but then when I transfer my script to French, I don't translate it word per word. I let my characters grow. I let the monologues take the space that they need in French, because I guess that when you are born in Montreal and your brain thinks in 2-3 languages, I code switch. So my characters code switch also, like they're different in French, and I don't want to limit them to translation. I let the play grow with the language. And in May, we're going to see and figure out what happens when that same story is told in French.
Oh, so you're going to be translating the whole show into French, and you're expecting that there will be some changes in terms of how the characters are sharing and speaking.
That's really what I'm exploring, because with my first play, that's what I realized, that when I was done with my first play, that was quiet. And then I really wanted to translate it to French, because I felt like if I forgot something, it will show up as I translate it. And that's exactly what happened. The characters started to grow. Some of the text started to change. And my final presentation, when I finally finished the French translation, I did a reading with a residency at Maison de la Culture. And that's how I realized that, okay, so my characters changed. My story changed. It's the same story, but it still changed a bit. And then I went back to my English script and fixed what was changed as per the last version in French. But that's how you see a story keeps on living. It grows. It grows with time. And I don't know if I'm still working on, if I would get an offer to continue working on Quiet or Sanctuary. Whenever I go back to a text, I feel like I'll work on it. So it's interesting because I get to work in different languages. So now I get different ways of letting the script grow. So I don't let the language limit what the character should be. I don't let the translation limit what the character should be. I let the atmosphere, the culture, the mood of the language take its space in my script. Lydia, but in the end, it should always be the same story. Sorry.
Right. You're saying so many different things. There's all these different threads I kind of want to pull on here. Can we talk about languages briefly? Just how many languages do you speak, or what did you start speaking when you were young?
Well, my home, I'm Haitian. So Haitian Creole is like, it's the language that your mom speaks. So that's the maternal language. I went to school in French. My name is Lydie Dubuisson, so I'm francophone. And English came into my life very quickly. I'm born between two referendums. And for some reason, I don't know, but my experience is that immigrants that are lost in small towns, we catch on English very quickly for representation. I needed to watch Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, so I learned English very quickly. So it's that was one of the things, but it's really true. And I remember, like, it may sound very like a segregationist thing, but in my high school, we were like a few immigrants, like barely a dozen, and we would sit together and we would speak in English to each other. And that's how we would kind of connect. We didn't have time to like figure out which part of the planet you're Greek, you're Jamaican, you're Haitian. We all sit at the same table and let's all talk about that last episode of Fresh Prince last night. So it's really, it's part of the Montreal identity to have like the language you speak at home, the language you speak in the society, the language you speak with your friends, the code switch that you have within that gang. Like I remember once there was a teacher who was like looking at our table like it was a social study, because I would be speaking to one of my girlfriends who was Haitian, so we would speak Creole or a French that was very like Creole broken, like a strong accent. And then I would speak to like my friend who would be Filipino, so then I would speak English to her. But then if a Quebecer would address me, I would speak to them like in. So that code switch is real, but it's not just a phase. It's I realize that when I translate, my characters change also with like a code switching when you talk. I am way more more of an extrovert in English than I am in French.
Wow.
So it's yeah. And it's a real thing, Montreal. It's a real thing.
And it's absolutely beautiful. And almost like your cafeteria table is more about being united by differences than separated by them, is the image I'm getting. And I also wonder if this helps you as a playwright, because you're also talking about all the drafts and the rewrites and the leaving characters and adding characters, but something people kind of forget is that when you're a playwright, you're writing the voices and the behaviors of many different characters. I think it's different from writing like a book or a short story. When you're writing for people to perform, you're inhabiting each person, right? Do you think, you know, growing up and needing to speak a different language or tone to different people, did that help give you an advantage as a playwright?
I embrace it. That I don't know if it's a strength, but I turned it into a strength.
Okay.
Because yeah, it's a gift to be able to not change skin, but to adapt to all of these different. I see languages as vibrations. Mm-hmm. So it's like you're capable of adapting to different vibrations, or you're capable of playing not just classical music, but also hip hop and also rock. And also like that's how I kind of see languages, the intonations, the rhythms, and even the definitions. A lot of terms exist only in English. They don't exist in French. They exist in French. They don't exist in Creole. But when you live in all three, it's definitely a bigger toolbox. I don't see how it could not. So with my first play, that's kind of what I discovered, is that I have a toolbox. I put some Creole, or there's a Creole character, or like the Creole culture is always present somehow. It doesn't even need words necessarily, but in quiet, it was the atmosphere that eventually I bring her memories back in Haiti without the language of Creole. In Sanctuary, Creole is like solidly there. And it's probably going to be there during the last draft also in French. But it's interesting to realize that when I take a language, the whole story of that language comes with it. So that's what's interesting to explore, that there's a poetry in French that does not exist in the same way in English. I feel very gifted to have access to all this literature, because it's kind of like when you realize that if you don't speak Italian, there are all of these music, all these songs that you do not understand.
Right.
You understand what the songs in English, but you're losing all of the romance in Italian, and you're losing all of the beauty in Spanish, and all of these languages, when you have access to them, it just makes your vocab, like your way of thinking differently, because we don't express things the same way. So to not use this for a play for me would be a waste, because yeah, my characters, Martha in Sanctuary in English is very grounded, very solid. And I can't wait to see what happens when she speaks French, because it's not going to be the same person, but it's going to be the same person.
speaking with Lydie Dubuisson, who is the artistic associate, the new one at Black Theatre Workshop, and also the writer of Sanctuary, a reading that you can still catch online at BTW's socials. You just touched on your heroine there. So let's shift to talking about Sanctuary, this piece that you that has gone through three different drafts that you've been working on. I love the title because we are literally in a place of sanctuary. You set this in a church, and your main heroine is there, and she's speaking to different people. Can you tell us about why you choose to set it in a church to have all these conversations here?
Well, it's those decisions. That decision came pretty quickly, I think. And I think it was not the original story. The first draft was not there. But I remember that after the first reading, that's when it came to me that she should just like run into the sanctuary and just stay there. And then it made so much sense because I grew up as an evangelical, in an evangelical community, sorry. And when you grow up and you're born in those type of churches, the sanctuary becomes it's your home, and it's also a holy space. It's a very, you're there like multiple times per week, not just on the Sunday, but on the Wednesday night, on Friday night for rehearsal. There's a difference between having rehearsal inside of the sanctuary and in the rehearsal room, because most churches have like a space for that. And the sanctuary is this space where once you're in there, you're supposed to have access to God. So to me, it made sense that if a 15-year-old girl really believes and is confronted with her destiny, what would be the best place to confront that destiny, to find the way? It would be the sanctuary. So to me, it felt natural to like place her there. And I feel like anyone who understands what a who had an experience with a sanctuary, and that's who I wanted to speak to. If you've been in contact with a sanctuary, if you've had a home in a sanctuary, that place speaks to that feeling.
And what kind of, I know she's questions, she's thinking about her future. There's so many different elements to pull on here, because there's race, there's gender, there is, what does she want to do? What were some of the important threads that you felt really needed to be, you know, laid out in this story? It's kind of as a coming of age story.
Yeah, as a coming of age story, of course, I used one of my own experiences as a teenager. And in our church was very controlling, and relationships were very, like, it was under the control of the pastor and the fathers. So I grew up in the 90s in Quebec under that type of ruling. And I felt it was very interesting to revisit these memories of being 15 and having the your whole community that takes care of you and that loves you and that you trust, just taking your destiny in their own hands. And how do we handle that pressure of knowing that everybody's saying like everything is fine, we're just making sure that you are going on the right path, but your own instinct is going against your faith. And you're still in a very contemporary world. You are still in the modern life. You cross the street, you go to school, you hear the music at the when you go to the stores and so on. But you are, when you're home and when you're at church, it's a whole other community, civilization, society with different rules. And as young girls, when we are in these communities, there's a form of feminism even in those fundamentalistic environment, those conservative religious environments. There is feminism in those spaces, but the question is, how are they allowed to spread their wings? Are they allowed to spread their wings? And Martha is, she's that voice. She's 15 and she's too smart for 15. and she has all of these questions about, well, I understand that, especially in that case, she is to be matched with her best friend. And I really wanted to play with that, because there's a lot of pressure on girls who, if a boy who has two arms, two legs, and a good brain and a nice smile, what more do you want? And there's that pressure of like, he's a great guy, you're a great girl, you're a match. And it's so much more complicated than that. And when we're teenagers, it's very easy to get cornered because you don't have all the arguments, but you have the questions, but you don't have the answers to those questions. So that's what Martha represents. And that's what I wanted to explore with that story. I wanted to talk about, because especially theater, the arts, there are a lot of topics that are explored, but religion is not something that we talk about a lot on our stages. And that makes me realize that there's a layer of society that we just like really don't talk about. And yet there's so many girls in that situation who still live by their community and who feel the pull of what do I want to keep and what do I want to free myself from of that community. So it's a complex story.
You might not, you're putting yourself in the place of a lot of people who may not want to completely throw off religion. You're still seeing positive, redemptive things in organized religion, but starting to question how much of it is going to control your life, as mm-hmm. Martha is doing.
And that's what I meant when I said that I took a break from what I was writing to really figure out what do I want to send out into the world. Because my plays are never about like church bad, freedom yay. It's about, no, what is the sacrifice of staying and what is the sacrifice of leaving? That there's a reason why so many people are appealed to religious communities or any sort of community with the rulings and the ways of being within that society for you to fit. So it's about that questioning and when is it your instinct and when is it what that society imposes you to follow? And yeah.
You feel like you're filling a void? You just said there's not a lot of plays about religion and giving this kind of nuanced, gray area look at things. Are you stepping up to fill a void?
I think that there's a lot of intersectionality to celebrate that we're not talking about. There's a lot of, exactly, because for a long time, I felt like I didn't belong in the arts because my story was so different. And I felt like I had to learn about everything about theater and figure out how to find a place in there. But then I realized that my story was unique, that my story was unique and valid and enough. And then I started to use my voice to write my plays. And then when I did my first reading with Quiet, I remember by the end, I had a conversation with a Catholic woman, I had a conversation with a Jewish woman, I had a conversation with a Muslim woman, and all of three were relating to my story, like, and all ages. I had like women in their 70s saying, this is reminding me of the time when I was a Catholic, of all of these different aspects of being a woman. So yeah, I do feel like I'm filling a void because we are a lot of female writers and we have a lot to explore. So all of our stories are, all of our stories have, like there's space for all of our stories. And I think that I'm happy that I finally realized that there's space for my stories. And I'm always surprised to see how easily people connect to these characters because you don't have to be evangelical exactly the same way Martha was to relate to the experience that Martha is going through.
So well put, Lady. This has undergone a reading that I'm going to point people to afterwards. You mentioned that there's more work to come with the play later in the spring, but what is like your big dream for Sanctuary? Where would you like to see it performed or who would you like to see in the show?
You always want to see a production. You always hope for a tour. I would love to have a bilingual cast who could play the play, this like to especially play both plays. I would love to have a bilingual tour because what's really fun about transferring a play, especially for me, again, gospel music plays a role in most of my plays. That was the same thing for Quiet and it's the same for Sanctuary. Gospel music is very present and gospel music is in English. But when I transfer it to French, I cannot translate gospel music to French, but I can translate gospel music to Creole music because Creole, the Creole spiritual tone is very similar to gospel music. And to me, it makes sense because I have strong fascination for collective memory, for what is transmitted in an ancestral vibrations. And it makes sense to me that what the same tone and the same vibrations that we can feel in gospel music is what we feel when we speak spirit, when we sing spiritual songs in Haitian Creole. And I would love to explore more in the West Indies to compare. But when I translate gospel music from English to French, Creole takes an even bigger space. So it's really rich. It's I feel like I'm going in circles with that. But yeah, I forgot the question actually, I think.
No, not at all. Well, we just wanted to know what your biggest dreams were for the play. And I think
Means that should we ever have like a tour, and if it's bilingual, to see how it's the same story but different, because like the moods of the songs are different, but it's the same songs at the same place at the same moment for the play. And my biggest dream would be production, tour. I would love for Montreal to embrace the plays in both languages. I would love for Canada to embrace the plays in both languages so that the rest of Canada can explore what it's like to have a play a little bit in French, a little bit in Creole. I am thinking of publishing both plays together, because Quiet and Sanctuary. Quiet is more the story of what happens to those kids of Sanctuary 25 years later, but I wrote that play first. But I would love to also do that. Like what happens when I show the first 15 minutes with Quiet and the second 15 minutes with Sanctuary, but you go back in time with Sanctuary. All sorts of dreams.
Lydie, we can only hope that all of them will come true and promptly, like very soon. It's been such a pleasure to talk with you, and congratulations on your new role as Artistic Associate at Black Theatre Workshop. Your time is much appreciated.
Thank you.
That was Lydie Dubuisson, author of Sanctuary and Artistic Associate at Black Theatre Workshop. See the reading of this play on the Facebook or YouTube pages of Black Theatre Workshop, BTW, which is the longest running Black theater company in Canada, also marks its 50th season with its annual Vision Gala this Saturday at 7 o'clock, virtually, of course. Artistic director Quincy Armorer co-hosts with board member Deanna Smith. And as mentioned earlier, choreographer Eddie Toussaint will be among the honorees. Singer Rani Lee is just one of the performers. It's free to tune in, and there will be prizes for those who register. Well, there's a raffle. Hopefully you'll win a prize. More info at blacktheaterworkshop.ca/vision. I'm Sarah DeA. You are listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at ckut.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. Still to come, the pandemic means missing out on in-person community events, but here is one community theater that just won't quit. I spoke earlier this month with Leslie Baker, the avant-garde solo artist behind works like F You, You Effing Perv, but she is joined in her latest work by a slew of other performers, distanced of course. It's called Skin, and it's part of the ongoing Wildside Festival, which does come to a close this coming Sunday. Skin and other pieces in the fest have been shortened and filmed for your on-demand viewing pleasure. Leslie enlisted two other artists to co-create the work itself, which poses the question, what does it take to lead a satisfying life? One of them was Joseph Schrag of Scapegoat Carnival Theatre, and the other is Emma Tibaldo of Playwrights Workshop Montreal. Emma spoke to me earlier this week. Good evening, Emma. Welcome to Upstage. How are you doing?
I am great, thank you, and I'm happy to be here.
Awesome. So we're meeting up here towards the end of the Wildsides run, a couple more days to take in these stories online. Your project, distinctive in the sense that it was the only one kind of doing live episodes and not just like a pre-recorded show online. What are your thoughts as the festival comes to a close? What's this experience been like for you?
Yeah, I'm still processing. It's been interesting to say the least, and it's been quite creatively invigorating, meaning having to be in a theater, having to think about things in a live format, even though there's no audience, but knowing that there's an audience watching the moment that you're doing it has been, again, an interesting process for all of us, how it all comes together, how do digital arts connect with live arts? What are the timeframes? Like all those, so many questions, so many possibilities, so many things to learn. I have to say it has made these last 3 months go by very, very quickly. And I'm still kind of in a whirlwind, like the second week of the show now, like the reruns of the live event of last week is going on right now. So it's my opportunity to actually watch them. And I've been trying to watch them in order in the way that they were meant to be presented. So I'm still in that very kind of icky place where you're watching yourself and thinking about the things that worked and the things that perhaps didn't work, or, you know, and does anything not work? It just doesn't work according to the way you thought it would work. But yeah, so it's kind of interesting being in it, seeing yourself, reacting to yourself as an audience member, knowing that that was a live performance when it was first done.
Right. The piece, Skin, about the satisfaction or an examination of the satisfaction of living. There's something mm-hmm. about that the mini thesis that intrigues me, this idea of how to kind of live a good life, how to live a satisfying life. When Leslie Baker, you know, put this idea forward and what her inspiration was, what about this theme spoke to you or intrigued you?
The ideas came out of, we were doing viewpointing. Like, we've been doing viewpointing together. She's been leading it for about, you know, 7 or 8 years. And and I was ruminating on, I've always been ruminating on what is the meaning of a human existence, like in the grand scheme of the universe and how the universe came to be and what our place is in it. What does my one life mean in all of this? And because I love to think about the infinite universe and everything out there and how we came to be and how ridiculously improbable us being here at this moment in this way is. Like, it's incredibly ridiculously impossible, and yet here we are. And you know what, my dad's almost 100, so wow. Thinking about the shortness and the longness of life and the meaning of life and all those things. So we all came to it with our own personal sort of feelings about the topic. And, you know, it started with also looking at the universe and looking at the stratas and what is the system of Earth that we, you know, the system that we live in, what is it? It's very small, but it's huge to us, like going into the stratosphere and into the exosphere and the troposphere and all of these things that we don't really think about them. So we were looking at those. So it all kind of came together over years of thinking and ruminating. And Seneca was something that Leslie was reading that she thought spoke to it very much. And so also looking at some of her stories from her life that came into this. And then, you know, and then there's Joseph Schrag and his incredible imagination and how he takes ideas and then transforms them. And then, you know, there was a lot of, in building the show over the last many years, and we've had two public performances of them, one in Montreal and one in Toronto at different stages of the process. And we had been working with the same movement people. So we were all working together and we were building a gestural vocabulary. And so COVID upended all of that as well. So, you know, the movement changed very radically, very quickly from what it was going to be live to then what it became for this iteration of it. And we do work at it differently under different restrictions. And so a lot of things evolved and changed and we fed on each other for many, many years and fed on each other. That sounds terrible. There like endless discussions, just, and I don't mean endless in a bad way. I mean, just pleasant, pleasurable musings on our existence and the life and what it can mean. And look at, you know, and COVID and being isolated brought a whole new meaning to what we were doing, because we started it way before we were in isolation. Like, so we were looking at the idea of shut-ins, of being, you know, women being trapped in homes or being unable to leave their home, and that expanding into what is our place in society, how is the patriarchy making our existence as women difficult, or how does it increase our anxiety, and what are the, you know, what are our barriers, and what is our inner rage? So again, looking at the ideas of introvert, extrovert, life, meaning, length, shortness, mm-hmm. getting old, spaces diminishing, you know, as you get older, your space gets smaller. It just does. You move less. Everything becomes part of your imagination. Like, you live so much more in your head, or at least my experience of getting older. So all those many, many things came together in skin.
Speaking with Emma Tabaldo of Playwrights Workshop Montreal and her work co-creating Skin, part of Centaur's Wildside Festival. I loved what you were kind of describing, the collaborations with you and Leslie Baker and Joseph Schrag, and these endless, endless conversations. It sounds so luxurious as you're kind of fleshing out, which is what is ultimately a philosophical performance piece. And curious about the creative process, where do you stop talking and stop having these conversations, and between the three of you getting down to work and like putting words on paper, like how does that process get going?
It always worked in parallel. So there was always movement, working in a studio over many years. People bringing in thoughts, ideas, pieces of writing. And so there would be segments of working gesturally, and then meetings around work being written. And so ideas coming forward and then discussing them. And then, you know, mostly Joseph would do the rewrites of the work, not of all, but of most of it. And yeah, so it came from texts and ideas that Leslie brought into the room, ideas that Joseph brought into the room, ideas that the movement brought into the room, ideas around that I brought into the room. So it was this constant sort of feedback loop of movement, words affecting the movement affecting the words. And I think that's what you see in the piece. And parsing those apart is difficult. The shut-ins basically came from movement, and then from there came the text, and then from the text came the movement, and then from the movement the text. You know, it just keeps looping.
It's building off of itself, I guess.
Yeah, I think in a way, yes. Yes, and of course then there's directorial, the directorial vision that Leslie has of how the piece comes together. And so of course that also affects what stories get told and how they get told and where they get told. It's been many years of talking and doing, talking and doing and talking.
Having worked on something like this for so many years, to see it finally come to fruition in a very strange set of circumstances, right? Producing work in winter during a pandemic. What does it feel like to finally see that fruition come to be?
I mean, it's an experiment, right? It's the first, you know, it's the first time I can say it's the first time I've done this. It's the first time Leslie has done this, and I believe it's the first time Joseph has done it, is, you know, taking a, a show that was basically being built for the stage and was very much about live and live theater, and actually looking at it even as an installation piece where people could walk through it as well. Like, there were a lot of discussions around how the audience interacts with the piece and what we're doing with the audience, to then have that taken away and have to, you know, change very quickly and deciding, well, do we go ahead or do we postpone it again? And it was sort of like, well, this is the opportunity to experiment, and let's experiment in trying to make the piece as theatrical as possible in the digital medium. So not, we decided we didn't want to do the live show and then stream it, because we couldn't, you wouldn't be able to capture it, what we were doing on stage, on film. It just wouldn't have been the vision of the piece. So then it was, how do we transform the piece so that it can have its own design, its own set of rules, its own process of being in the digital world. And so that had to happen very quickly. So I'm thrilled with it. Like, I think there's some really great and exciting intersections between sound and visuals and movement and snippets of philosophical discussions that may pique your interest. There's humor, there's irony, and there are moments for me of great reflection, especially, you know, in those three or four pieces of suspended kind of animated movement that run through the piece. So it tells a story. Is it the final story? No. Is it the way we had envisioned it? Absolutely not. Are we happy and proud of it? Absolutely. Are we going to learn from it? Yes. Is it, you know, everything it can be? Well, it's everything it can be in the parameters that we had, and in the way that we were working. And I'm just grateful to every single designer and artist that worked. Everybody gave everything they had. And so that is what I'm most proud of, is, well, proud is a weird word, most excited by, is that, you know, everybody gave it everything. I think it's a fucking awesome experiment.
Emma, it's such a treat to speak with you. Thank you for taking the time to take us behind the scenes of Skin. It's much appreciated.
My pleasure. Thank you for taking the time to listen.
That was Emma Tibaldo of Playwrights Workshop Montreal and co-creator of Skin. You can see Skin as well as the other performances in the virtual Wild Side at centaurtheatre.com until Sunday. This weekend, the festival has a side portion called Catalyst, putting the spotlight on budding writing talent, including Amelia Sargeson, who you heard from earlier this month. She is an actor who is taking free time during the pandemic to focus on writing, and she'll be sharing from her solo work, For Shame, on Sunday. Tune in Saturday and Sunday at 2 o'clock for Catalyst, centaurtheatre.com. I'm Sarah DeAy, and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. I enjoy hearing from the good folks at Lakeshore Players Dorval. The community theater in the West Island is always busy, putting on a whopping 3 shows a year. And they, like everyone else, are trying to stay connected in the time of Zoom. Bill Fletcher is treasurer and a longtime volunteer, and he is directing a performance of The Leading Ladies this weekend. Ken Ludwig's farce finds 2 struggling Shakespearean actors who hatch a scheme to get rich. It just involves some acting. How hard could it be? Bill spoke to me earlier this week. Good evening, Bill. Welcome to Upstage. How have you been?
Just excellent for these times, Sarah.
As good as can be.
You got it.
One of the things that's so tough, I think, for everyone is that so many things that you do, you know, besides work and besides family, I was just thinking about this today, you know, like we don't have your sports league, your hobby group maybe isn't getting together in the same way, or your community center is closed. And that means community theater is also impacted, of course, by the pandemic, but it is staying strong and alive on the internet. And we're here to talk about Lakeshore and what Players Dorval and what you guys have planned for this coming week. Can we start with that sense of community and what it means to not be able to see the people that you normally work on plays and readings with? How has that been like for you?
Well, it's a change in lifestyle is what it is, Sarah. Usually, Lakeshore Players puts on three full main stage plays a year, which is an adventurous schedule. And I've been involved with Lakeshore for 25 years, I guess, and very involved on the technical side of theater. And it's almost a full-time hobby for a lot of people. When you're putting on three shows a year, you put on one, you'd start the first show would take place on stage in November. For that one, you've got to get going in August. Yeah. The second, so it's activity from August to November. And then the second show would go on stage in the first week in February, which takes you from probably the second week in December till the third week in February when the show comes out of the theater. And the third show would take place in sometime in the spring, late April, probably. So for the people that are really involved with it, it's a continuing activity. And there are a lot of people. There are a lot of people. It takes a lot of people to put on a show. And that's all gone. Like as of COVID right now, that's a memory. The last show that we did actually closed in, I think the second or third week of February 2019, just almost a year ago now. And we were lucky enough to get the show closed and play our last show, last performance, got all the equipment out of the theater and into storage, and boom, everything shut down. So we went from fast motion to no motion at all. So yeah. It is a shock to the system.
You're just talking about how it can, if you're very involved, it can be a big chunk of your year, a big chunk of your time. What do you miss in particular? Is it working with other people? Is it the excitement that comes from putting on a show?
I guess there's two things. I miss the activity, obviously. I'm very involved with the set construction. I've been doing set construction for a very long time. And I miss that activity. They'd be two or three days a week. And then when you get close to the show, probably a lot more than that. But, you know, the other part of it that I really miss is the creativity. You know, it's like doing a painting and then putting it up on the wall so somewhere public so people can see it. It's a team sport that does that, but it's actually getting the thing done and having it out in public. And if it's not very good, well, it's not very good. And if it is very good, holy smokes, is it fun. And I miss those two aspects. I miss the activity and I miss the creative side of the whole thing.
And it's also tough too, because being online isn't quite the substitute, right, that we might have originally thought it was, right? In your case, you're saying the creativity, that connection, but you're a set design guy. There's no sets to be built, right? There's no hands-on work that is going to happen in this pandemic time.
Well, you're right. And I got to tell you, when you put together, you know, you work hard on a set and it seems, you know, who cares? It's furniture. Well, some of it is, it's a little more than furniture. And, you know, on the odd time when the curtain opens and the audience applauds when they see what's up there, that's magic. And we're certainly not having any of that these days.
Well said. Speaking with Bill Fletcher, he is directing Leading Ladies this weekend with Lakeshore Players Dorval. Let's delve into that. So play reading, what is this going to look like and what's the show about?
Well, I think play reading is a great thing to discuss or to, you know, to think about, because a play reading can take a whole bunch of different forms. I've done over the years, I've done lots and lots of play readings in all kinds of different fashions. The most basic kind of play reading is a whole bunch of people sitting around a table with their scripts in front of them, actually reading the play. They never look up, and you can do this in front of an audience. Poor audience. I mean, it may be odd. It might be entertaining sound-wise, like radio, but unless you're very talented, it's difficult to just sit there and produce a quality product sitting there and with your head down and looking at it. And certainly as an audience member, it's not the world's greatest. It's fun to do, but it wouldn't be on my list of prime things I would want to watch. The second way to do a play reading is what they call a stage play reading. And in a stage play reading, you're probably in a room with an audience that's in a small room or in a small theater, a gymnasium, whatever it is, but you don't have a set. You probably don't have a stage, but the actors are going to be get halfway to doing the show. They're going to be standing up, moving around. They're going to have scripts in their hands because they haven't memorized the script. They don't have an elaborate set like we would for a theater show. And they don't have elaborate props and probably don't have the sound effects that you might require, but they are moving around and they are, there's real physicality to a stage play reading. And it can be really entertaining for the audience. And then you've got a third kind of play reading is what we'll be doing, or what you can do online. And of course, that's what we'll be exploring on Saturday. The online product, again, there's a number of ways of doing an online play reading. You could do an online play reading like we're doing this interview. We could do it over telephones.
Right.
Yeah. Another way to do the play reading would be to be on Zoom, and all our faces would be on the screen, and we would be reading the play. Not quite your stage play reading. The way that this is being presented is more we're moving more towards the form of cinema, a cinematic style of presentation, where on the screen at any point in time, you're really only looking at the people that are talking, the people that are involved right now with what's going on. And you're seeing their faces. Their faces you're not seeing their full body.
Right.
When you get back on Zoom, if you get back far enough from the camera that it can see your upper body or see you standing there, the actor becomes disconnected from the audience. It's just too far away. But if you're uptight with your face in the screen, you can really connect with you can connect with the actor. You can see what he's thinking. You can experience his emotions. And if the only people that you're looking at on the screen are the people who are actually involved at the second, for instance, if there's 12 people in the room, in the play, and two of them are talking, we would only see the two of them on the screen. In that format, you can get quite close, I think, to a cinematic quality of entertainment.
So how do you, as a director, give guidance to your actors, knowing that they'll be dealing with, you know, the specific vision that you have, like how to make things really kind of pop off the screen and it's so interesting about how you give guidance. Like, what's your plan?
Well, we rehearse. No, we rehearsed last night. We'll be rehearsing. We'll be running the thing tomorrow night. But we had a rehearsal last night, and if anything, it's exactly the same as directing a stage production. I would like the character to be more like this. I would like the character to be more like that. When you're working Zoom into a camera, there's facial issues. There's physical things that you can do in this kind of a production. If a character is being dragged off to jail, and particularly in a comedy, when a character is being dragged off to jail, you could have an offstage hand come in and grab him by the throat, by the shirt collar, and pull him off camera, and it would be funny. And those kinds of things you develop together. The director might have an idea. The actor might have a better idea. And but the process is exactly the same as a stage rehearsal. We'll do scenes, we'll have notes, we'll change it, we'll do the scene again.
Bill, want to touch on the story itself, leading ladies. One of my colleagues and friends, Tracy McKee, is one of your leading ladies. Tell us about the story.
Oh, well, it's a comedy, and it's set in the 1950s. Not particularly for any good reason, but it's a nice time to set things in. It's a long time ago. And it's a story of two British actors who they're Shakespearean actors, they're trained actors, and they've been involved with theater in the United States. And for one reason or another, they're now touring together, putting on Shakespearean scenes wherever they can get booked. And at the time that we catch up with them, they can get booked at the Moose Hall Lodge and the Order of Odd Fellows clubhouse. So they're touring the American Midwest, going from the Odd Fellows Lodge to the I can't even remember the name of the town, but it's the Laurel Order of the Moose. So these two fellows are traveling around putting on these Shakespearean scenes wherever they can, and it's not going terribly well. And they discover from the newspaper that a local lady, an elderly lady who's in ill health, has been searching for several years for her lost two children, the children of her sister that moved to England many years ago. They're her only surviving relatives, and she's been looking for them. And the two fellas decide that it would be a good idea to impersonate those two missing relatives, the younger relatives, and show up as the lady is in desperate ill health, so they could perhaps get away with the inheritance. And the fat gets in the fire when it turns out that Max and Steve, the missing relatives, are actually Maxine and Stephanie. So the two young actors have to put on dresses and impersonate the missing heiresses, and that's the story.
So very much being much more comic, I think, than I was expecting.
If we're in the middle of COVID, we don't do drama.
Well, I think it's going to be, in that context, it's always appreciated, a good laugh, right? And I'm sincerely hoping that not only your players, but your audience as well will get a big kick out of it. Bill, it's been really nice to speak with you.
It's great to be here with you, Sarah.
That was Bill Fletcher, director of Leading Ladies at Lakeshore Players Dorval. Subscribers to Players can watch the live stream of the show this coming Saturday evening at 7:30. Of course, it's not too late to become a member. Visit lakeshoreplayersdorval.com for more information. You have been listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca. Tonight you heard Lydie Dubuisson, author of Sanctuary and artistic associate at Black Theatre Workshop, Emma Tabaldo of Playwrights Workshop Montreal and co-creator of Skin, Bill Fletcher, director of Leading Ladies at Lakeshore Players Dorval. Thank you to all of my guests. You can hear past episodes of Upstage at ckut.ca under archives. Thank you to Tamara at CKUT for making sure this show gets to air, and thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Sarah DeA. Speak with you next time on Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and ckut.ca. Stay home and stay safe.
This message is intended for all Quebecers. We must take extreme measures to curb the pandemic. Only essential services remain open. Gatherings are prohibited. It's forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. These efforts aim to protect our healthcare workers, seniors, and loved ones. Let's comply with the lockdown and curfew to lower the risk of contracting COVID-19, because our health is important. For more information, visit quebec.ca/confinement. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec. This message is intended for all Quebecers. We must take extreme measures to curb the pandemic. Only essential services remain open. Gatherings are prohibited. It's forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. These efforts aim to protect our healthcare workers, seniors, and loved ones. Let's comply with the lockdown and curfew to lower the risk of contracting COVID-19, because our health is important. For more information, visit quebec.ca/confinement. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal.
The January 28th edition of Gray Matters. Tonight we have a legacy presentation by Howard Zinn from Alternative Radio. At the end of tonight's show, we'll give you all the particulars so you can obtain a transcript of tonight's show or any of the vast catalog of presentations from Alternative Radio. The title of tonight's lecture is American Exceptionalism, and it was delivered in August of 2005. So here it is, Howard Zinn and American Exceptionalism.
What's the answer to this very dangerous notion of American exceptionalism, of our right to do as we will in the world? The answer is that those of us in the United States and in the world who don't accept this idea must declare very forcibly and act very vigorously against this idea and insist that ethical norms should be observed and that no country should be an exception to the rules of morality in world affairs.
That's Howard Zinn, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Howard Zinn on American exceptionalism. In classic imperialist style, the United States exempts itself from the standards that it applies to others. This is a fundamental tenet of American exceptionalism.